Okay, we are back, World War Civ, and we are going out onto the waves.
And under them.
And under them, yeah. Although, people who follow this episode, it's not the first time submarines have been used. People who follow Civilizations podcast know that the Irish invented the submarine, didn't they? The Fenians had the first submarine, I think.
Well, there was one during the Civil War.
Yeah, but I think the Fenian one was before that even.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. But now we're scaling up. We're scaling up. Like with so many things, World War One is the time when some of these systems really come into their own and become a part of warfare for the rest of the next 100 years. Well, until today, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought that. I thought this was an episode that, you know, we have to do because there was a war at sea. And once I got deeper into it, I realized this is really, really significant. I mean, in one sense, it's technology meets war. They make friends. It's also connected to, you know, how you've reacted to the, you know, the idiocy of the generals and the land battles. Well, you get the same phenomenon here. But also, I think that this is where the war was basically decided.
You know, it was that's a big deal.
It is. It wasn't. It certainly wasn't victory on land. And in the competition of industry, you know, just to produce more shells and so on, that was huge. But it was all influenced by this. I read a whole bunch of articles, some by historians and some by former naval officers. So, of course, I have A.G.P. Taylor, Barry Turner, R.K. Middlemas, Barry Pitt, S.W. Roskill. I have the Battle of Jutland from two perspectives, Donald McIntyre and Friedrich Ruge. I also have a bit by Wolfgang Steglich. And also by Arthur Marwick. I have to give a shout out to Arthur Marwick. When I was in university, obviously listeners can tell that I like political and military history, but they had us read stuff like Fernand Braudel's History of the Mediterranean, which is all
naval.
No, it's
naval political economy or something, right?
I mean, no, it's economic. It's food.
Yeah.
It's you know, trade routes and ships,
yeah,
and all that stuff.
Yeah, I read some of that. I read Braudel around the same time as I read Emanuel Wallerstein. So this is it's the world system. So they try to analyze the global economy, basically.
Right, right.
And
but Braudel gets down into stuff like, you know, acorns.
Yeah. Wallerstein too, for sure.
And local markets.
He had a book called like The World System, and it's like four parts. And it blew my mind when I read it. I was probably 18 or 19. It was, you know, after your class. It was my first year of university. And I found this book called The World System. And I was like, what is that? I want to know about the world system. And I would read it back and forth on the bus as I was commuting.
Right. And in the same neighborhood, I encountered Arthur Marwick, had to read an entire book of his on British social history. And he gets into things like daily diet, housing.
Right.
Transportation, and it was just super, really super. So you'll see the connection between the war at sea and Arthur Marwick a little bit later in the episode.
So I just want to say I read a lot of military history too, but it's usually kind of left-wing focused, and the military theorists of the left are often guerrilla theorists. You think about Mao Zedong or General Giap from Vietnam, or you know, Svechen, Soviet military theorists, and they're all pretty focused on land.
Yep.
You don't get a lot of left wing naval theory, and I think there are probably some sound political economic reasons for that, but let's just say this is not something that I come to with a real deep reading background. So this one is gonna be mostly all Dave for listeners, just so you know.
Okay. Well, our listeners probably remember, or some of them anyway, will remember that one of the main causes of World War I was the naval race. The British and Germans building more and more huge battleships, the dreadnoughts, and rendering earlier types of ships obsolete. So when the war began, British Admiral Jacky Fisher predicted a naval Armageddon. He said in September of 1914, it will happen, the clash of two huge fleets of these giant dreadnoughts. And of course, that didn't happen.
Because the Germans didn't want it, right? I mean, the Germans were doing their best to avoid exactly that. Because they knew they would lose, so they just wanted to make sure they had a fleet throughout the war. That was the sense when I read Tuckman. I mean, this is just from Barbara Tuckman, a couple of chapters of Barbara Tuckman.
Yeah, their idea was to keep their fleet in being as a threat. And as long as that threat is there, the British have to maintain their enormous fleet, you know, in the North Sea to prevent them coming out. And both countries, as of about 1910, they were building new ships, cruisers. The dreadnoughts are huge, but their range is limited. The cruisers can go much farther, much faster. But they both started keeping the new cruisers for the battle fleet. And that meant that, you know, around the rest of the world in colonial waters, they were leaving their older designs, their older types of ships out there. I mean, why not? There's no competition, right? Except for possibly Japan, and the British had already signed a naval agreement with them. So the British had to do the same. They could barely afford to build new dreadnoughts, so any new cruisers were also kept for home waters. And that left county-class cruisers built between 1895 and 1905 for use in colonial areas. And it turns out that the county class was a bad design. It was deficient in both speed and armaments, and they were also too expensive to scrap. So you've got all these obsolete ships in use, and it wasn't until they actually came into combat that these deficiencies were revealed. We also covered in our episodes on the causes of the war, the flight of the Goeben. You remember that German cruiser in the Mediterranean? And how it ended up going to Turkey and bringing the Ottoman Empire into the war. So when the war began, the British were panicking about these two German cruisers in the Mediterranean. And another cruiser, the Emden, was in China. It was in the German base at Qingdao. The Emden sailed from there to the Indian Ocean and went on a rampage. The Emden sank 9 merchant ships, bombarded Madras, sank another 10 merchant ships near Sri Lanka, and then sailed into Penang Harbor to do more damage. They sank a Russian light cruiser and a French destroyer. So the hunt for the Emden, the British were all over the Indian Ocean chasing this one German raider. 78 British ships were involved in the hunt. And finally, an Australian cruiser, the Sydney, caught the Emden, and the Emden's captain ran her aground on the Cocos Islands. There was also the cruiser Königsberg, which was active in Africa. They sank a ship carrying most of the tea crop from Sri Lanka, from Ceylon, off the coast of Aden. And obviously that makes it a clear threat to the Suez Canal. And then the Königsberg went and bombarded Zanzibar in Tanzania and went up a river in Tanganyika to hide. And the British had no idea where the Königsberg was. There were 3 armed ocean liners. So the Germans wanted ships with long-range capabilities, so they armed ocean liners. 3 of them escaped through the North Sea and headed for American waters. These ships could attack merchants, but they could also be used to resupply the cruisers. The cruiser Karlsruhe sank a ship in the Caribbean and then went down the coasts of Brazil and Argentina and putting the British into a panic. In September, Captain Köhler sank 20 more ships in the West Indies. And months later, the Karlsruhe was headed for Barbados, which was undefended. You can only imagine what they could have got up to there. And on a clear day, for some inexplicable reason, the cruiser exploded and sank, along with most of its crew. Huh. Now, all
nobody,
of
the, nobody knows nobody why. Nobody took credit for it?
No.
I have a question, though. So these are German cruisers that are doing so much damage, but and the British design was not very good.
No.
Presumably the German cruiser is better?
A little more modern and better design, yeah. Okay. Now, these ships pose a serious threat to Britain, to their trade routes, but they couldn't go after them all right away. The Königsberg, for example, terrified them because the Royal Navy was planning to transport Indian troops to Britain. We talked about this before, right? But by the end of 1914, they desperately needed troops on the Western Front. Those are going to be Indians, and we have to get them there. That means shipping them through the Indian Ocean to the Suez Canal and then through the Mediterranean to Britain. And then also Australian and New Zealand troops have to be shipped to Egypt. The idea of one of these cruisers catching a bunch of troop transports filled with soldiers just gave them nightmares. So the Royal Navy has to provide heavy escorts for them, and that tied up their ships for a while. So while I found the story of the cruisers very interesting, and some naval experts criticize both sides for concentrating so exclusively on the big ships and the big guns, the dreadnoughts, and failing to have enough of these fast cruisers. And they criticize the Germans for not having enough of these fast cruisers to do more commerce raiding, like the Emden. But honestly, I don't see how long they could have kept it up. Mm-hmm. I mean, these ships have to resupply, right? And the Germans don't have colonies. That many bases. They don't have that many colonies. And they don't have coal in those bases. They were very ingenious with having colliers, coal ships, basically, rendezvous with these cruisers in neutral waters in places around the world. It was very clever, but they could only keep it up for a while. So for a number of months, these cruisers gave the British major headaches, but it wasn't going to be decisive. Now, there was one thing that made them lose some sleep, and that was the German Pacific Squadron. So Admiral von Spee, or von Spee, S-P-E-E, was in Chinese waters. And he knew, with the Japanese declaration of war, that once Qingdao was attacked, he would lose his base and his only source of coal. He let the Emden go to the Indian Ocean. He knew that one ship could supply itself from captured vessels. So Spee's plan was to sail his squadron for home. So to avoid the Japanese fleet, he crossed the Pacific, and he met up with some of these coal ships at Easter Island. Now, the German squadron was quite powerful. It had the Scharnhorst, Gneisenau, Nürnberg, and Leipzig, and the light cruiser Dresden. And Dresden brought news of the only British ships nearby. Admiral Craddock had an old armored cruiser, the Monmouth, a new light cruiser, the Glasgow, and an armed merchantman, the Otranto. And they were reinforced by an armored cruiser, Good Hope. Spee knew that this British force could not match his. So there was no reason to, you know, not to proceed and not to face them. So the two little fleets came into contact off Coronel on the 1st of November. And it was an absolute mismatch. So this is one thing I learned about the naval war was I don't care how brave your sailors are. Training helps. But if you are using inferior equipment, don't even bother. It was ridiculous. The Germans opened fire at a range of 12,000 yards, which the British couldn't match. So Craddock had his ship steam directly towards the Germans. And Spey simply had the Germans, you know, back up while continuing to fire. And the British ships took a pounding, and the Germans were completely unscathed. Good Hope exploded. Monmouth limped away from the battle. And when the Germans caught up later, refused to strike her colors. They refused to surrender. So the Germans sank it. And there were no survivors from either of those ships. The other British ships were hopelessly outclassed. So when the fight started, Craddock ordered them to run. And this was, as I say, quite a revelation. Not just to me, it was a revelation to the British Navy, who thought that courage, skillful handling, and the traditions of the Royal Navy could offset bigger guns, longer ranges, and superior numbers. So now they realized that sending inferior ships into battle was inviting a massacre. So they sent two battle cruisers, the Invincible and the Inflexible, two ships that were as superior to Spey's squadron as his had been to Craddock. They threw in three of the old county-class cruisers and two Leis cruisers and Vice Admiral Sir Frederick Doveton Sturdy. My gosh, you got to love some of these names.
What was he?
Sturdy enough. Spey was tempted to stop in at the Falkland Islands to destroy the British wireless station there. So he's now crossed the Pacific, rounded the tip of South America, and he's at the Falklands. And this new British force who were sent to chase him were at the Falklands loading coal. So Spey turned to run, and on December 8th, it was his turn to be outgunned. Four of his five ships were sunk. The British suffered few casualties. The fifth ship escaped only to be caught in March, and its own crew scuttled it. They blew it up. So Cornell was a wake-up call for the British. They had several months of anxiety hunting these German cruisers. But the truth became clear. Surface raiders can have a great success. They can have a string of successes, but their lifespan is severely limited. So I am actually surprised that in World War II, the Germans did some of the same thing. They had surface raiders and some famous ones, right? Like you might have heard of the Bismarck and the British chasing it for months. But this isn't going to...
Must have been what they had, right? Until they produced submarines, right?
Yeah. I just, in hindsight, I'm thinking, you know, why did Hitler allow the Germans to rebuild a big surface navy, which wasn't going to be decisive in any way? So both sides, especially the British, failed to foresee the importance of two new weapons, mines and submarines. The Germans were slightly better equipped in these. I think we mentioned before, the British had so few mines, and they were so useless, they had to borrow mines from the Russians. But neither side really understood how to use submarines yet. They were seen as auxiliary to the fleet, able to scout, maybe even embarrass a battleship. But to use them against merchant ships, that really didn't occur to anybody right away. The Germans, the U-boats, had a very short cruising range. And I don't know what people are thinking about them, but the technology was such that they couldn't go that deep and they couldn't stay underwater that long. They literally had to surface for air and to recharge their batteries. And on the surface, they're very vulnerable. So the Germans were unwilling to risk the Straits of Dover, which were quite crowded with shipping and very well defended. So the German submarines went the long way around the north of Scotland, and they lurked around the approaches to Britain's western ports, so Bristol and Liverpool and Glasgow particularly. On September 22nd, 1914, a single U-boat sank three armored cruisers, Aboukir, Hogue, and Cressy. October 27th, the battleship Audacious was sunk by a mine. And Taylor says that the Admiralty were so perturbed by the loss of the Audacious that they kept it a secret until the end of the war. And now, with the Submarines active, the British realized that they had neglected to protect their main naval base at Scapa Flow from submarines. I mean, a submarine could literally sail into Scapa Flow and let loose torpedoes, and there was no defense against it.
Scapa Flow being on the British Isle, like
it's at the northern tip of Scotland. So in November, the sight of a single periscope, which turned out to be a false alarm, sent the British fleet fleeing. They went to the west of Scotland, and then they went to the west of Ireland. And they didn't come back until well into 1915. So with the British fleet so far away, the Germans were able to send out raiding parties of ships. They bombarded the British coast twice, killing civilians and, Taylor says, killing civilians and breaking windows in Scarborough. And their third raid was less successful. They were caught by British cruisers and, quote, badly knocked about. This is from another former naval officer who seems to have compared naval war to cricket, like a sport. So I think we mentioned before that the British had broken the German codes thanks to Russia. So they knew when the Germans were setting out. They knew when these raiding parties were coming and could arrange to meet them. The Germans did not know that their codes had been broken. Meanwhile, the British, on their side, did what they always did, what they did against the French Revolution and Napoleon and what they did against Russia and the Crimean War. They instituted a blockade.
Blockade.
Yeah. We're not going to let you trade. We're going to cut off your supplies. And this brings up some very interesting concepts like international law. So there was a 17th century Dutch jurist named Hugo Grotius, Grotius. And Grotius put forward a claim for what he called Mare Liberum, or freedom of the seas. So ships from all countries should be able to sail around the world and go where they wish. And the British reply was, he who commands the sea automatically acquires the right to control all traffic passing over it. And sounds they like asserted.
Sounds like a good doctrine if you're the one who commands the sea.
Yeah, might makes right. And we have the biggest navy, and therefore they asserted what they called belligerent rights. Understandably, this was not popular with neutral nations, and it's one cause of the War of 1812. It's one reason why America went to war with Britain in 1812 for all the interference with their trade, stopping American ships and so on.
It's interesting that Grotius is writing in the 17th century because in the 17th century, I guess, the Netherlands was also a pretty big naval power.
Yes, they were, and pretty much at war with Spain the whole time.
And yet he didn't say might makes right.
No, no. So after the Crimean War, privateering was also abolished. Privateers were basically state-sanctioned pirates. So all countries did this. You give a ship captain license to go and capture enemy merchant ships. And if he's caught, he's not a pirate, he's a privateer. And that legal distinction means that, you know, he'd be a prisoner of war rather than scheduled for a hanging. So after the Crimean War, privateering was abolished. This is a net benefit to Britain, who has more merchant ships than, you know, anybody else. Actually, they have more than almost everybody else combined. But the abolition of privateering seems to exempt the property of belligerent states from capture. So it's no longer legal to go after our merchant ships. It also seems to support Grotius' idea of freedom of the seas. But then there's the question of what about if the cargo is arms? Should that be exempt from capture? So they talked about this before the war at the Second Hague Conference, 1908-1909. And the naval powers met in London, and they tried to define contraband. They came up with three classes. Absolute contraband, these are war materials. Conditional contraband, something that might be used for war materials, which might even include food. And if it's carried in neutral ships but headed to your port, does that make it liable to capture? And then the third was free goods, commodities like oil, cotton, rubber. So these weren't meant to be.
So this is more progressive in 1908 than today, because according to the U.S., today Cuba or Venezuela or Palestine can't have anything.
Right.
If we or our allies, Yemen, are at war with them, they're not allowed to have anything at all. And they make lists of drugs, you know, toothpaste, you know, women's sanitary products. They just draw up lists of contraband that are absolutely absurd. So we've gone backwards since 1908.
Well, I think it depends on who rules the waves, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
The rules change. The Americans were furious at Britain for imposing a blockade. But yes, as time goes by and the Americans have the ability to impose a blockade, then their attitude changed. Surprising, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or not? Yeah, so as the war began in 1914, Britain announced that they would adhere to this three-part standard. Some historians say that this was short-sighted, but there were two reasons for it. The first was that at that point, nobody understood that it was going to be a long war. Remember, they all thought it was going to be over by Christmas. So there's no point. We know that the Germans have stockpiles of arms and whatever. So, you know, there's no point doing it. It was only when they realized, oh, this is going to be a contest of industry, this is going to be a battle of endurance, then they changed their minds. And the second reason that they didn't start the blockade right away was they didn't want to offend neutral countries. I mean, especially the U.S., but others as well. But as the war went into 1915, yeah, they started to realize, okay, so the wide oceans are open to British shipping. They can access food and raw materials from anywhere. But they can use their navy to deny those to the Germans and impose a blockade. In the French Revolution, they used a close blockade. That is, they parked their – actually, they didn't park them. But they had their warships circling around outside French and Spanish ports so that the moment – French ships left there, they would be in combat within the first couple of hours. Well, that's no longer possible because of submarines, mainly though because of mines. So what they did is they built up a distant blockade. Some call it an invisible blockade. And they did it by controlling the exits from the North Sea. So if we block the English Channel and the Straits of Dover, and if we block the seas between Scotland and Norway, then ships from around the world cannot get to Germany.
Okay, I lied. I have been thinking about these kinds of issues because there's some interesting analogies to what's happening with Yemen, right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
So Yemen, Ansar Allah in Yemen has said, you know, we're not allowing any ships to go to Israel while Israel is doing the war in Gaza. And so they've basically blockaded the Red Sea So they don't let anyone go. The Gulf of Aden, they attack in the Gulf of Aden, but they really don't let anyone go through the straits there, the Bab al-Mandab, into the Red Sea, unless they have their permission. And,
right,
and so,
right.
So the U.S. is in the Mediterranean, and they're basically preventing any other third party from going into Gaza, right? So they've got their fleet, and that's also not a close blockade, because they're worried about Iranian and other missiles. So they're parked, it's not mines, but they're kind of parked just outside of the short, you know, the missile range of some of the bigger missiles that pro-Gaza states have, or organizations have, while they blockade anyone from trying to get in. So there is a very, very complicated naval battle going on right now.
It's complicated in terms of international law. So we're blockading, and that's okay. Their blockade, that's a rogue state.
Yeah, exactly. How dare you blockade us while we're trying to blockade you? How dare you deny our ship's entry while we're denying your country food? So it is a very interesting. There are certainly analogies. The idea of a close versus an invisible blockade is very interesting to compare to today.
Yeah, and for similar reasons. So German ships were automatically stopped and confiscated. So German agents operating in faraway ports made arrangements to transfer these cargoes to neutral ships. And that made tons of money for neutral countries. Dutch and Scandinavian imports rose dramatically. And obviously, they didn't need all that stuff. The surplus was being passed on to Germany.
Overland. Right?
No. Well, yeah, from the Netherlands, sure. That's easy. But the Scandinavian countries, I mean, Denmark could ship it overland, but Sweden could, you know, just skip it across the Baltic. And the British can't interfere.
So the other thing that's going on with Yemen right now is flags of convenience, right? So there's a lot of ships that are where the Yemenis are like, this was a British ship or an American ship, and it was headed to Israel. And then the British are like, no, it wasn't. It was from Tuvalu or whatever. And so there's a bit of an intelligence battle going on, too, to identify ships that are saying that they're not British, American, or Israeli, but in fact are. So this all started 100 years ago, I guess, with this blockade.
Or you could say, you know, even earlier, certainly French Revolution and Napoleon, the British were doing this too.
And were did the French try to use neutrals and different flags and stuff to?
Yeah, like, and they had blockade runners.
Okay.
So fast ships just trying to get past the naval ships or go in when it's foggy or, you know.
Yeah.
And certainly the Americans were doing a lot of that blockade running. By July of 1915, all of those, you know, German cruisers, the surface raiders, had been accounted for. Now, that was a legal form of warfare. That was legitimate warfare, at least by the rules that had been agreed to by everybody. But as German submarine attacks increased, this opened up a gray area. So I put it later, but I think it's worth mentioning now. So there was a style of submarine attack. Most people imagine that they're, you know, lurking under the waters with only the periscope showing and firing a torpedo. In fact, submarines would approach a target underwater and then surface next to them. So the threat, it's like showing up by surprise with a loaded gun and saying, hands up. And merchant ships, you know, don't have arms. So even the small cannon on the deck of a submarine is, you know, fatal to them. So you really have no option but to surrender. So you stop, and now the Germans board, and they look at your cargo, and they sometimes assist the crew to getting into the lifeboats. And then once the crew are in the lifeboats, you sink the ship. And they usually use their deck gun to do it because they had plenty of ammunition for that gun and they had a limited number of torpedoes. So this is called cruiser style attack. And there's a gray area in the Hague Convention. What about the crew in the lifeboats? Because if the submarine simply sails away, you're leaving these people, you know, exposed to the elements.
Yeah, it's not, they don't have, you don't have much of a chance if you're just in a lifeboat in the, on the high seas.
Right? No, no. And it's not like you want to allow them to send an SOS because a warship will show up and that's bad for the submarine. So the British made a big noise about this being a violation of the Hague Convention, and that gave them the excuse to break rules themselves. So what they did is they simply wiped out the distinction between contraband and free goods. Any cargo destined for Germany, even if it came from a neutral port, even if it was carried on a neutral ship, the British said it could be seized. Now, the neutral countries are going to protest, but there's not much they can do other than that. So neutral ships were escorted to British ports. Their cargoes were checked. War materials destined for Germany were simply denied passage. Now, what the British did that was clever was they offered to buy these cargoes instead. So you neutral guys, you know, you may not get top dollar from the Germans, but we're going to buy your cargo. So it's not lost, just got, you know, reoriented. In 1915, the Northern Patrol cruisers intercepted 3,098 ships. A year later, 3,388 ships. 743 and 889 in 1916 were sent to British ports for examination. So they're going to check the ship's license and origin. They're going to check the cargo and their destination, and you know, most of them they will let go. But anything, you know, suspicious, anything headed for Germany, any war materials, not getting through. To avoid being stopped by British cruisers, many neutral ships started voluntarily calling at British ports, like, well, it going through customs. So we'll stop, let you examine the cargo. Can we go now? Okay, good. To make things easier, British consuls in faraway ports issued neutrals with clean bills. So giving them documents that will allow them to pass through the blockade. And the British even had a Ministry of Blockade. Tell you how big this is. Ministry of Blockade under Lord Robert Cecil, which worked very closely with the War Trade Intelligence Department. And these guys comprehensively studied the shipping and the economies of neutral countries. They could tell, for example, your history of trade, you know, how much of this stuff you import annually. And when you start, surpassing that by a significant amount, we know what you're doing with the surplus. You're sending it on to Germany. Meanwhile, the British also controlled the coal supply. They actually controlled the coal bunkers in many ports around the world. And if your ship was suspect, you could be denied access to these facilities. Also, remember, London was the banking and insurance capital of the world. So they could also refuse to extend financing or insurance to companies that they deemed suspicious. So if we think you are running stuff to Germany, you're going to go on a blacklist. In February of 1916, they published the statutory blacklist of companies in neutral countries. And the British controlled most of the world's cable communications and wireless. So it made it pretty difficult for shipping companies to communicate and to avoid these measures. So the neutrals resented these restrictions. The Americans protested vehemently and defended the principle of freedom of the seas. And that lasted until they entered the war, and at which point they turned around and assisted with the blockade. So how did this impact Germany? German agriculture was very efficient. Before the war, Germany produced 2/3 of their own food and fodder requirements. But the Germans had failed to stock up on important war materials before 1914. And that meant that the blockade became a very powerful element in, can I do a spoiler here? In their eventual, you would never do such a thing.
I would never object to a spoiler.
Okay. You're being honest. To Germany's eventual defeat. And they also made several missteps, which cost them the propaganda war, which was pretty important in terms of America was going
to
do.
What do you think? Why do you think they failed to stock up? Because
they thought the war would be over by Christmas.
Right. Okay.
Right. All of our other wars with Austria and France, whatever, were over in a matter of months. And now our army's even bigger. Right. Those armies were tiny compared to the force that we mass now. So they just failed to realize, yeah, but so is the enemy army. There's literally no room for the maneuvers Yeah. So one of these key examples, I'm surprised how many people have heard of this already, was the ship, the Lusitania. This was a Cunard Line, a British ship. It was the largest and fastest passenger liner in the Atlantic. It displaced 32,000 tons and was called a floating luxury hotel. And it was still operating. The German embassy in the U.S. paid for an advertisement in the travel pages of several New York newspapers. And their advertisement was a warning that British and Allied ships sailing from American ports could be in danger if they entered the European war zone. So their warning, do not sail to Britain, because that could be very dangerous for you. Only a few people took the warning seriously. One piece of logic was that Lusitania is simply too big and too fast for a submarine to catch. Also, you know, surely the Germans wouldn't risk angering the Americans by attacking a ship like this. And there were plenty of celebrities who were booked to travel to Britain on the Lusitania. Multimillionaire Alfred Vanderbilt, theater producer Charles Frohman, famous actors, famous businessmen. And if they weren't worried, you know, why should we? And finally, why would the Germans want to attack basically a floating hotel? So despite the advertisements, there were only a few cancellations, really not much more than usual. And a large crowd turned up to watch the Lusitania leave the harbor. So what the Germans actually achieved was putting a spotlight on the Lusitania and drawing attention to it. Nobody in the crowd watching it leave, and the passengers either, none of them knew that the Lusitania was carrying more than people. In the holds were 4,200 cases of small arms ammunition destined for Britain. Remember, the British could not keep up with arms production on their own, and they were buying from the Americans. So this
is a big psychological barrier. They didn't think that the Germans would do it.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. But if they're carrying ammunition, that makes the Lusitania a legitimate war target. And wouldn't you know it, there was a U-boat cruising the Irish Sea. This was U-20, commanded by Captain Schweiger. And he had not had much luck. He'd prepared to attack once, but saw a merchant ship flying the Danish flag and let it go. So he rounded the southern coast of Ireland, sank two ships on the 6th of May. And the British Admiralty issued a warning of U-boat activity, but they didn't send any warships to the area. They didn't send any patrol boats out there. Now, Captain Turner of the Lusitania got the message of U-boat activity. And apparently he was concerned, but he stuck to his course. And on the 7th of May, U-20 spotted the big liner and fired a single torpedo at it. There was an explosion followed by a second explosion. And that second explosion, the British and Americans argued that the U-boat had fired two torpedoes. But in fact, the investigation proved pretty clearly that the first torpedo basically set off the ammunition in the hold. The Lusitania was not well prepared. They had actually had lifeboat drill, and the passengers all had life jackets. But the ship was moving too fast. I don't know if you've ever seen, you know, film or pictures of these huge liners, but the lifeboats are hanging on the sides of the ship, and they actually swing out. So the Lusitania was moving too fast, and it was beginning to list to one side, so that it wasn't actually possible to get into the lifeboats properly. So there was confusion and panic. After the first explosion, it took 18 minutes for the Lusitania to sink. 1,198 passengers and crew drowned, and that number included 128 Americans.
Apparently, the Lusitania had avoided the iceberg that sank the Titanic.
Yeah. I'm not surprised.
It had sailed successfully 200 times, more than 200 times before getting sunk.
Ah, okay. I didn't know that. So. Probably why they thought they could do it again. Yeah. So now the Germans made a series of really bad mistakes. First, the German press celebrated the sinking as a great success. Allied newspapers predictably called the Germans pirates, murderers, and criticized, quote, the hideous policy of indiscriminate brutality, which has placed the whole German race outside the pale.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's fighting words. Oh, but this is the British press already. This is
yeah, this is the British press. So they carried out an official inquiry, skirted around the fact that the Lusitania had been carrying munitions, and concluded that two torpedoes had been fired. And then the propaganda battle got even hotter. And it was because of a guy in Munich named Carl Gates, who cast a medal to celebrate the event. He meant it to be satirical. He meant it to mock the Allied obsession with business, and also to expose the supposed impartiality of the U.S. He got the date wrong, but his medallion ended up attracting a ton of attention. One side of the medal shows the ship sinking with the words, the liner Lusitania sunk by a German submarine, 5th of May, 1915. So he was off by a couple of days. It's the reverse, though, that really did a number. The reverse shows the ticket counter of the Cunard line manned by a skeleton. And there's a lineup of passengers. One man is reading a newspaper with the headline U-boat danger. And another figure, supposedly the German ambassador, raising a warning finger. And then there's also the text underneath, Geschäft über alles, business above all. So Gates is really criticizing, their love of business, and, you know, willingness to risk death for profits.
As opposed to glory and the glory of the race and whatever else he's...
Yeah. Unfortunately for Gates, the original intention was lost, and the British did a real number on it in terms of propaganda. They just totally submerged what he intended, and they depicted his medal as a rather macabre celebration of the sinking. And they also blurred the lines between what was really just Gates's, you know, like one man's idea and an official German government commemoration of the event. So they made it look like the German government had commissioned this medal to celebrate the deaths of all the passengers. They were so successful at it that in January 1917, the Bavarian War Office prohibited any further production of the medal and ordered all available pieces confiscated. Too little, too late. Then we get to 1916 and the only really big naval engagement of the war, the battle that everybody was expecting. So, mentioned it before, early in the war, a German naval officer was found drowned in the Baltic, found by the Russians, and he was carrying a copy of the German code book. And in a rare act of Allied cooperation, the Russians passed the information on to the British. So from then on, they could decipher every German message sent by wireless. The German fleet, everybody knew, was numerically inferior, so the only possible strategy for them was to find a way to divide the British Grand Fleet. You know, if you can meet up with half of it, you could do a number on them. So the raids on the English coast, mounted by German battle cruisers under Admiral Franz von Hipper, these attacks were to draw out the British. Now, the battleships were too slow to intercept the cruisers, but the British had their own battle cruisers under Admiral Sir David Beatty. The cruisers, the British cruisers, were moved to the port, the Scottish port of Rosyth, further south from Scapa Flow. And in January of 1915, that led to the Battle of Dogger Bank. The German armored cruiser Blücher was sunk, and another cruiser, the Seydlitz, narrowly escaped destruction. A shell actually penetrated the turret and started a fire in the ammunition. And the Germans quickly opened some valves and flooded the magazine to save her. So these raids were not having their effect. And I guess the high command was disappointed that their expensive, huge navy was not being more active. So a new admiral was promoted at the beginning of 1916. This was Admiral Reinhard Scheer. Scheer was eager for action. Now, the strategy has to be the same. He knows the British fleet is superior. He has to lure them into smaller, isolated encounters and wear them down. So he intended to use submarines and zeppelins as scouts. So he had a number of these airships. And he had 16 U-boats, and the U-boats went out first to take up position. Unfortunately, the weather got bad, and the U-boats were unable to maintain their positions. So Scheer set an alternate trap at the end of May. Hipper would go ahead with the battle cruisers, so it's going to look like another raid. This is the bait. And then when Beatty responds with the British cruisers, Scheer's going to pounce with his battleships before the British main fleet can respond, which is a pretty good plan, except that the British are reading your messages. So British Admiral John Jellicoe got the warning, and he sailed out with the entire Grand Fleet to catch the Germans in a trap of his own. So the German submarines failed to deliver any successful attacks, and even worse, they failed to realize that the whole British fleet had left Scapa Flow. So Scheer had five battle cruisers and 16 dreadnoughts. the British had 9 battle cruisers and 28 dreadnoughts. And that's not counting the other ships, including a large number of destroyers.
This is a huge battle.
250 ships and 25 admirals. No shortage of admirals. So Beatty with the British cruisers engaged Hipper with the German cruisers. 2 British ships were sunk, but Beatty pressed the attack because he wants Scheer and the main fleet to come forward. And when they did, Beatty turned to flee and Scheer pursued for 2 hours until the British Grand Fleet appeared on the horizon and Scheer turned away. Now, Jellicoe didn't really press the pursuit hard. His doctrine seems to have been that it was more important for him to preserve British ships than to sink German ships. He was afraid of running into submarines or running into a minefield. He thought the Germans had laid mines and that, you know, that was part of their trap. But, you know, neither one was an issue. Half an hour later, the Germans reappeared because Scheer had tried crossing the T. So instead of simply fleeing directly away from the British, he wheeled around to try to catch them, to pass across their rear. This is the classic maneuver that all admirals have tried or are of hope to be able to accomplish. But now the two fleets actually run into each other. They're in range, and they fired at each other for about 15 minutes. And then both turned away. But the result was that Jellicoe was now between Scheer and his base. If the Germans are going to get back home, they're going to have to get past the British. Now, they can go a couple of ways, and Jellicoe had to guess. And Jellicoe guessed wrong. McIntyre, one of the authors I read, says that Jellicoe was in the right place, but the Germans performed an about face. This is a very difficult maneuver for such big ships. Scheer's destroyers came out to screen the retreat, and they fired 28 torpedoes at the British fleet. None of them hit, but the British warships had to turn to avoid them. Now, this is a little strange to me. I don't understand why the destroyers didn't get hammered by the British battleships. These ships don't have to turn broadside. There's something about that I don't understand. But then the reports of the Battle of Jutland are sometimes conflicting. So the Admiralty in London deciphered another message. They informed Jellicoe of the direction that Scheer was taking, and Jellicoe chose to ignore the information. This is really weird and hard to explain. Taylor suggests that Jellicoe didn't trust newfangled inventions like the wireless. So this this is right. Something we've seen with the generals, right?
Yeah, not exactly early adopters of technology.
No. It's amazing how many of the top generals were cavalrymen, and they still thought in terms of, you know, the cavalry breaking through. And I guess some of these admirals grew up in the days, you know, long before dreadnoughts and wireless, and they don't trust these technological toys. So the German fleet got home safely. That was the end of the battle. The British lost 3 battle cruisers, 3 armored cruisers, and 8 destroyers, 6,000 men killed. The Germans lost 1 old battleship, 1 battle cruiser, 4 light cruisers, and 5 destroyers, 2,500 men killed. The after battle analysis is interesting, though. British gunnery had been inferior. Some of their shells broke up on impact instead of penetrating the German armor. So that's faulty weaponry. And then the armor of the British ships was defective. One battle cruiser blew up because of a spark that passed down the ammunition hoist and blew up its own ammunition. But it's hard not to simplify it just down to this. At the decisive moment, the German fleet fled from the British. And Jellicoe rationalized that he didn't think he could win the war by destroying the German fleet, but he thought that he could lose it if he didn't preserve his own.
That's not unsound.
No, but it's not popular.
It's not aggressive.
Right. So the public opinion in Britain had themselves a little hissy fit. He's not aggressive enough. So in 1917, Jellicoe was replaced by Beatty, who was more aggressive. But now that he's in command, Beatty got more cautious.
So it's the constraint of the position. As soon as you get there, you look at what you have, you look at what they have, and then you become conservative.
Yeah, well, it's like Ludendorff taking over for Falkenhayn, right? Ludendorff criticizes Falkenhayn. He's too cautious. You know, we need to go on the offensive in the East. And then Ludendorff takes command and goes, yeah, we're not going to win the war in the East. We have to, you know, stay on the defensive. And he adopts the same policy that he was criticizing. So essentially, the two fleets canceled each other out. The ratio of the strength between them was unchanged. The blockade went on. And about 100 destroyers that could have been used against submarines were tied up at Scapa Flow, basically defending the British Grand Fleet. So the real danger for Britain, it wasn't that the Germans might think they had won at Jutland. In fact, it was the Germans' clear realization that they hadn't won, or at least that they weren't going to gain by trying again. Like, another battle like Jutland's not going to do the job. So German shipyards switched from building surface ships to producing submarines. And German sailors were taken off the big ships and trained for U-boat service. And the German crews that were left on these big battleships and cruisers, well, they were sitting in harbor, and they were unhappy to be left sitting in harbor. They became disaffected. In August of 1917, there was an open mutiny. And a year later, August 1918, so the war is coming to a close and everybody knows it, and Hipper decided on one last, you know, glorious gesture, and he ordered the German fleet to sea, and there was open revolt.
So they didn't like being left in harbor, and they didn't like being ordered to sea.
No, but the order to sea, they realized this is a suicide attack, right? This is all about honor and stupidity, and we prefer not to die for honor and stupidity. So German admirals, the lesson that they got from Jutland was, we're not going to win on the surface of the water, but we could win with submarines.
Which may not be the right lesson.
but it's the one they learned.
At the end of all this, the German admirals began to see unrestricted submarine warfare as the only way to defeat Britain.
Yeah, and this is just of enormous significance. Yeah. And it didn't happen all at once, right? So let's go back for a second to cruiser style. So when the war began, there weren't very many submarines and their range was limited. And when it came to attacking a merchant vessel, the customary tactic, which was called cruiser style, was to surface near the target, surprise, and you threaten them with a deck gun. Of course, you have torpedoes as a backup, but unarmed merchantmen, you don't need that. So the merchant ship, the crew would be allowed to take to their lifeboats, and then the ship would be sunk. There's no room on the submarine to steal the cargo. You're going to just destroy it and deny it to the enemy. So the reason that they did this style was that torpedoes were expensive, and a U-boat could only carry a very limited number, whereas ammunition for the deck gun was cheap and plentiful. The second reason that they did this was international law and the rules of war. Now, we saw in the invasion of Belgium that the Germans didn't always worry that much about international law, but in this case, there are neutral states that you don't want to offend. So what the Germans should have done was they should have tried to get international recognition for what is essentially a new weapon. Instead, they admitted that it was, you know, technically illegal to sink ships without warning, but they argued that this was a reprisal for the British blockade, which was also illegal. And once again, they lost the propaganda war. You know, maybe they
could. Yeah, I mean, it's not a good plan to say, well, they're doing illegal stuff, so we should be able to do illegal stuff. That's never a great argument, right? Why shouldn't we be able to do this awful thing?
And it's worse than that, because what the British are doing is confiscating cargoes. What the Germans are doing is sinking ships and killing passengers and crew members, or leaving them in open boats. You know, there's no room for them on the U-boat, so you're leaving them in open boats exposed to the elements. Like, who knows when help is going to get there? Surprisingly, Kaiser Wilhelm was one of the few political leaders who expressed humanitarian concerns about this practice. For him, the drowning of innocent passengers was, quote, a frightful thought.
The sensitive Kaiser.
Well, no, you know, he loved his yacht and spent a lot of time sailing around. Oh, so
he identified personally with the fear of being stuck out of the ocean. Yeah,
that's my take on it anyway. Now, U-boats had some spectacular early successes against enemy warships, and that encouraged Chief of Naval Staff Admiral von Pohl and Admiral Tirpitz, encouraged them to speak of the possibility of establishing a submarine blockade of Great Britain. They blockade us, we blockade them. But celebrating the victories of these U-boats gave the German public the impression that submarines were a super weapon, an infallible weapon. And the press, the German press, started calling for ruthless action or all-out war. And, of course, these phrases do not translate well, and they don't sound very good.
Yeah, don't. It's you're not helping. You're not helping the propaganda war at all.
There's a trend. I mean, we saw it when we did episodes on the German unification, right? This this powerful German respect for might, particularly armed might, right? And the militarism and all of that stuff. And it's
after Belgium already.
Yeah. Just not a good look. There was one British response to submarines that had a big impact, and these were Q ships. They are merchant vessels with hidden guns. Q ships were named after Queenston, Cork, the docks where many of the ships were converted. So a Q ship is basically a trap. When a U-boat surfaces nearby, the defenseless victim suddenly opens fire with cannons. Now, there were about 157 Q ships and other decoy vessels that saw service. It's hard to get a definite source. I found another source that says 180. So I don't know what qualifies as a Q ship or decoy vessel, but say between 150 and 200. They only sank 14 U-boats. They damaged some others. That's only 10% of all the U-boats sunk. There were other far more effective weapons against submarines. And 27.
But it's appalling for a German captain to have to worry about. You're just trying to sink a merchantman, and then you have to worry about them opening fire on you. How dare they?
Well, yeah, but that's the whole point, right? It's not the actual numbers of U-boats that were hit by these Q ships, it's the psychological impact. The U-boat skippers are now afraid to surface next to a merchant ship. They're afraid of a trap. And German admirals used Q ships as an argument in favor of unrestricted submarine warfare.
Right. You should be able to sink. You should be able to safely sink a merchant ship, obviously.
Well, okay. It sounds funny when you put it that way, but I can see it from their perspective. There were also merchant ships that tried to ram the U-boats. And there's also the danger that naval vessels, British naval vessels, would arrive while the U-boat was searching the cargo or allowing the crew to evacuate. The longer you spend on the surface as a U-boat, the more vulnerable you are. So there is an appeal to firing a torpedo from, you know, when nobody knows you're there. But the biggest danger to U-boats, mines. That was news to me. I didn't realize how many mines were deployed and how terrified both ships and U-boats were. There's no way to detect them unless you see them. So I saw a photograph of a U-boat on the surface with about 30 of the crew on deck with rifles, and they're all scanning for mines. Because if you hit one, you're potentially done, right? Now, the British didn't have very good mines. We mentioned this before. It took them until 1917 to develop a good one, and they did that by copying the Germans. But they used mines and nets in the Straits of Dover to create a near-impenetrable barrier. Now, you have surface ships patrolling as well. So this is very daunting if you're a German submarine and you think you're going to go through from the North Sea to the English Channel. They had 5,000 mines there,
wow, plus so their nets. They're basically floating mines.
Yes, or they're tethered just under the surface. Mm-hmm. So that's scary. But I mean, still, U-boats did sneak through 250 times alone in 1917. But this is mostly at night and on the surface so that they can potentially see the mines. But the British also knew German exit routes from the Heligoland Bight. So remember the Kiel Canal? Germans could sail from the Baltic, just below Denmark through their canal, and exit in what was called the Heligoland Bight. And the British knew all these routes, remember, because they had broken the code and intercepted all the messages. So they also placed a lot of mines there. This is an underrated and underreported part of the naval war is this combat between mine layers and mine sweepers and patrol boats. So both sides had hundreds of little vessels doing these jobs. There's also a problem in that the German Navy did not inform their government of the true statistics when it came to submarine warfare. So, for example, from May to July of 1915, 86% of the merchant ships sunk by submarines were dealt with by cruiser style. From February to July, 250 ships under neutral flags were stopped by submarines and examined. The cargoes were examined. Only three were found to be British flying a false flag. So the argument that we have to fire torpedoes, without warning, cruiser style is working, and, you know, the danger of stopping neutral ships is not that great. And there aren't that many, British cheating with the flag. But the Navy did not release these statistics because they didn't want to be permanently limited to cruiser style. They wanted the option to go with unrestricted warfare. And as for, having a real blockade of Britain, they just didn't have enough submarines. In 1914, they only had 20. It took days to sail across the North Sea and back. And the U-boats could only stay on station. They could only patrol an area for so long. So in February of 1915, they only had 21 U-boats available. Between the travel time and the overhaul afterwards, there were never more than three or four U-boats operating on the coasts of Britain. This is according to Wolfgang Steglich. In March of 1915, he says, only 21 ships were sunk. Now, Steglich says 21 out of 5,000. He's trying to highlight how limited, the submarines are in preventing you know, naval traffic. But his 5,000 number is wrong. I know where he got it, and that's not correct. There were not 5,000 merchant ships sailing in and out of British ports every month. That number came from the British Admiralty, who were trying to make a point, which we'll get to later. A lot of the vessels were coastal vessels, so they're just going along the coast from one port to another, carrying, I don't know,
like
what.
Like the equivalent of a motorboat or something today.
Motor launches, colliers, coal.
Yeah.
Fishing vessels. And I'm not sure what else, but, you know, sinking these was not all that valuable to the Germans. Several U-boats were sent to the Austrian naval base at Pula. Pula is in Istria, now part of Croatia. And they were very successful there. By 1916, though, they were encountering more armed merchantmen in the Adriatic and the Mediterranean. So they asked for permission to sink enemy ships without warning, and it was granted.
And whose ships are they sinking?
Italian, British, because the British are supplying their army in Turkey, right, okay. At Gallipoli. And there's also a lot of traffic between Egypt and, right. And then there's also the French had to worry because they're bringing colonial troops from Algeria and Morocco to France.
So this is all Mediterranean naval warfare.
Right.
But so this was the North Sea stuff is not, right? The North Sea is across the Atlantic and everywhere. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So the Navy called this intensified war. They didn't call it unrestricted.
Or all out.
Right. Right.
So that's the press. I mean, I just, the other thing I wanted to just say is, like, I want to call listeners' attention to the fact that the press is actually inflaming the situation. And I think a lot of the times people think the press is restraining or something, but it's really not in the build-up to and during World War II, the press is always more jingoistic and more trying to push for a more warlike policy, right?
Well, I think it's like today. You have a couple of fairly responsible, newspapers who are reporting the facts to, you know, reveal this is what we're actually doing, but they're drowned out by, as you say, the drumbeat of the nationalist jingoistic press. Yeah, for sure, they're making it worse. There was an important conference at Charleville on the 4th of March 1916. This is general headquarters of the German armed forces. So the war minister Falkenhayn is there, so is the Kaiser, and so is the Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg. So Falkenhayn told them that the war had to be brought to an end by the end of the year. He said, the German army is not going to last. We can't keep sustaining these kind of casualties, and we can't win on the battlefield. So the only way to win the war is with unrestricted submarine warfare.
And perhaps not even that.
Yes. Is that your quote from Excalibur?
Yeah, I thought you'd appreciate that one.
I did. So the Chancellor still opposed it. In fact, he was hoping for some kind of compromise peace. But he used military arguments instead. There aren't enough large U-boats available. We only have 14 at this point. And the Kaiser couldn't make up his mind, so he postponed a decision. But the Navy went ahead and, quote, intensified the campaign. They declared a war zone around Britain. And they did this publicly. So the message to neutral countries is enter at your own risk, right? There's going to be shooting going on here. So if you come in to the western ports of Britain, we're not responsible for your safety. So more ships were sunk without warning. And the neutrals all noticed. In fact, the U.S. thought that the Germans had already started unrestricted submarine warfare. So on the 24th of March, after two Americans were reported erroneously, but were reported to have died when a passenger steamer, the Sussex, was torpedoed. There were two Americans, but they were only injured. President Wilson sent a note to Germany threatening to break off diplomatic relations. And that helped the Chancellor persuade the Kaiser to call off the escalation of unrestricted submarine warfare. The Navy commanders protested, cruiser style is too dangerous, they said, for U-boats. Not true, but the Kaiser doesn't know that. So the German answer, diplomatic answer to President Wilson was they agreed to return to cruiser style so long as the U.S. now persuaded or somehow induced the British to abandon their illegal activity, the blockade. So again, this is kind of juvenile, isn't it? We'll stop if you make them stop.
Yeah.
So the German government, quote, reserved its complete freedom to alter its decision if this was not done. And Wilson replied, I think, fairly correctly, that German respect for the rights of Americans couldn't be made dependent on the actions of the British government. It has to be absolute, not relative. So, I mean, the Americans are not happy with the British blockade either, right, but you can't make us responsible.
Yeah.
So the failure at Verdun, which we covered in an earlier episode, led to the replacement of Falkenhayn by Hindenburg. So the new Minister of War, and behind Hindenburg was Ludendorff doing the actual decision making. Hindenburg, the figurehead, and Ludendorff, the decision maker. Ludendorff quickly came to the same conclusions as his predecessor, Falkenhayn. He went on to the defensive in the Western Front. The Germans prepared a second line of concrete dugouts and gun emplacements behind their front line. It was shorter, incorporated more advantageous terrain, and rather than using villages as strong point, they used, better terrain. But they knew that every village and every field was of sentimental value to the French, and, to the Germans, it's not. So we're quite happy to tear up villages and replace them with concrete bunkers. This line was called the Hindenburg Line. But Ludendorff knew that a defensive position isn't going to win the war. So he came around to agreeing with Falkenhayn, the guy that he had undermined and had him dismissed. So with Hindenburg's prestige behind him, Ludendorff now started preaching unrestricted submarine warfare. And Bethmann Hollweg, the chancellor, is stuck. Interestingly, he never believed that a decisive victory was possible. His hope was that a compromise peace was achievable, especially once the generals and admirals came around to agreeing, or at least admitting, that the deadlock was unbreakable. The irony is that he had supported the appointment of Hindenburg and Ludendorff because he knew how Falkenhayn thought, and he thought that Hindenburg's prestige would make negotiations more acceptable.
What do you think of this? Because this actually sounds like correct. Like if the Germans had just said, okay, from 1916 on, we're going to focus on defense and not try to win, then wouldn't there eventually have to have been a deal? I mean, yeah. I guess there was a deal with the Russians because of the revolution, but then would there have had to be a deal on the West?
Oh, wait till we get to the revolution. There were lots of attempts to reach out and say, hey, what about a compromise peace?
Right.
But you could write a book about all of the failures to reach a compromise peace, right?
Yeah.
Because they're so short-sighted. Oh, we're having a good month.
Yes. Yes. And this is probably going to be the last month. We're just
about to. Right. Or, yeah, sure, we'll do a compromise peace. We want to keep Belgium, Northern France.
Yeah.
Russian, Poland. Yeah, we'll just keep, you know, these millions of square miles that we've acquired, and we'll give you back, you know, a couple of crumbs from the table.
Scraps, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, but you know what? I find that in a lot of these wars, there are guys who see, you know, the correct policy, or they see the truth. The horrible thing for humanity is that they're not listened to.
Nobody, yeah, they can't get it. They can't get it across. I sometimes feel that way.
A little? Yeah. So now the military men are embracing the possibility that they could bring Britain to the brink of starvation. So, army men now looking at the Navy as the solution to the deadlock. And the politicians gave in. They let the military men make the decision. Now, by the end of 1916, the prospects for, you know, this all-out U-boat war were better. Germany now had 105 submarines, 46 large and 23 smaller, available against Britain. World harvests had been bad, and they calculated that if they began their campaign before February, it could really hurt the British, who are dependent for a large percentage of their food on imports. The Germans calculated, or estimated rather, that they had been sinking 400,000 tons of shipping a month. The actual number was 325,000, but that's still pretty significant. They believed that with unrestricted submarine warfare, they could increase that figure to 600,000 a month. And at that rate, and with neutral shipping frightened away, it was expected that Britain would be forced to sue for peace. As for the possibility of the worst case scenario, which is America entering the war, the generals thought that it wouldn't result in an increase in the supply of American war materials. This is curious. So by their calculation, Britain and France are already being equipped with American war material, so it won't make any difference. And they also didn't think that any substantial number of American soldiers would be coming to Europe.
This is a major miscalculation.
Actually, you know what? It's not. Huh? No. No, I mean, spoiler, when we do get to the Americans coming into the war, they didn't show up in huge numbers.
Oh, is that right? I didn't
know. Yeah. Yeah, I thought they showed up like a million guys showed up. Nope.
Yeah, the eagles at the end of Lord of the Rings. I thought it was a big...
No. Okay, so first of all, they were kind of right about the war material. The first American troops that showed up in France had to be equipped by the British and French.
Oh.
Yeah. Uniforms.
This is all news to me, yeah.
It was to me, too. And in terms of numbers, the Americans could have sent over a ton of guys and had them trained by the British and French. They could have been incorporated into the British and French armies. But the Americans wanted their own separate force.
Yeah, they don't do that.
They don't do that.
They never have, and they never will, yeah.
Right. So instead of a million guys showing up all of a sudden, it was more like a few tens of thousands.
Oh.
They were not significant at all. The Germans were correct about this. I mean, in the long run, they're incorrect. But yeah, they thought that they had plenty of time to strangle Britain. And is even if America...
Is that a characteristic of German strategic thinking, that they're better in the short run than in the long run? It seems...
It seems like it's everybody's like military thinking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Haig kept saying, oh, we'll win the war by the end of this year. And yeah, then next year he would say, oh, we'll win the war by Thanksgiving. No, they don't observe Thanksgiving, but certainly Christmas kept coming up. The politicians, though, were worried, and correctly worried, about the effect on Allied morale. Britain's not in the greatest of shape, and France is definitely wobbling. But if America comes in, they're going to be encouraged to hold out longer, right? All we have to do is survive another year, and then the Americans will show up. and they'll be encouraged by American financial resources. So the generals are calculating military supplies and manpower, and the politicians are thinking maybe a little more clearly.
We have a episode about war aims and how they expanded beyond into truly delusional territory for Germany especially. But like, what do the Germans think winning is at this point?
Okay, so I think both sides are now reaching the point where a compromised peace will be unacceptable to your population.
Yeah, yeah.
After all of your talk of victory, after all the promises that you've made, yeah. Remember Lloyd George promising the workers that, you know, after the war, everything's going to be great.
Yeah.
And we'll fund all this stuff with German money because we're going to make them pay.
Right. And the Germans want to loot the Turkish treasury. Was that right? Or no, the British wanted to loot the Turkish treasury. Sorry. That was one of the projects they mentioned, is if we loot Constantinople, we can.
Yeah, so when you're dreaming of this kind of stuff, yeah, any politician at this stage coming out in favor publicly of a compromise peace is going to be lynched. And as you say, it's partly your own fault, and it's partly the press who have raised all these expectations of complete victory, total victory. Anything less is going to look like a defeat. That's a problem for Russia too, isn't it? So on the 1st of January 1917, Hindenburg and Ludendorff took the responsibility, and the Germans announced unrestricted submarine warfare. And you might think, why would you announce it? Why wouldn't you just like do it? Well, they're trying to intimidate neutrals. They're trying to keep them out of this war zone so that they don't have to sink too many of them. So all shipping, they declared, including neutrals, would be sunk on sight in the Eastern Atlantic. So we're extending the war zone. On February the 2nd, President Wilson broke off diplomatic relations with Germany, but he still has a hope. He's hoping that there'll be some kind of compromise peace and that he will be called in to mediate. And then he can advance American interests while brokering a peace between the combatants. But then came the Zimmermann telegram, which you remember from our episodes on Mexico. And we'll bring it up again later. It's pretty fun. So on April 6th, Wilson reluctantly declared war on Germany. Quote, "It means that we shall lose our heads along with the rest and stop weighing right and wrong."
Oh, man.
That I had the same reaction, and then I thought, okay, but wait a second. Wilson, I think, actually believes this.
He doesn't. Yeah, he's a KKK man lifelong, so I don't know. I'm sure he has some idea of right and wrong that wouldn't exactly fit with what ours would be.
But. Right, and if you ignore the Spanish-American War, yeah. And intervention in Latin America over and over again, you can Caribbean. Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And as you say, he's going to keep his distance, and America declared itself an associated power, not an allied power. So from this point on, you have Germany and the Central Powers fighting against the Allied and Associated Powers. So the U-boats started sinking anything they saw. In April alone, German submarines sank over 1 million tons of British and neutral shipping. One out of every four ships leaving British ports never came back. Neutral and American merchant vessels started refusing to sail there, and there was no way to replace so many ships. A few more months of that, and the war would have been over. So in that sense, the German calculations were correct. Part of the problem is the British had neglected agriculture before the war. Here's where I got some great material from Arthur Marwick. 80% of Britain's wheat and 40% of her meat had to be imported. They had relied on Austria and Germany for almost all of their beet sugar. So these imports being cut off is a critical threat. So you have the strain on civilian morale, very severe. Even though the crisis point, if you want to call it that, was limited to a few weeks in the summer, there were shortages and long queues, lineups, if you want the translation. Voluntary rationing was announced in February. Families were asked to limit themselves to 4 pounds of bread, 2.5 pounds of meat, and 3/4 of a pound of sugar a week. But margarine, fats, milk, bacon, they all quickly became very scarce. Sugar and butter were almost unobtainable. And even tea. It's hard to imagine Britain facing a tea shortage, but they did. And they came out, the government came out with government control tea. I don't know how they made it, but consumers compared it to sweepings off the floor. So, but even that, even government control tea was hard to get. This is when upper and middle class families turned to substitutes. And I didn't know this, but this was when the dish shepherd's pie became widespread.
Because it's ground beef, and ground beef is cheap, is the idea?
Well, it's ground beef in potato. Yeah. It's not a pie with flour.
Oh, I see. So
the British are huge pie eaters, right?
Yeah.
Steak and kidney pie and every kind of pie. Shepherd's pie has no pie. It's ground beef and potatoes.
They just called it a pie to make it seem like it was a pie. But here's the thing. This is imperialism, right? It's not exactly neglect of agriculture. It's just you have a system where you get everything from your vast colonial system.
Okay. But it's a miscalculation to over-rely on it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the British notion of food sovereignty or food security, as people to use the current terms, is the empire.
And yeah,
they don't really get the, you know, it's not exactly like sovereignty doesn't mean the same thing to the British at this stage, I guess.
No history. I get you there. But I found it interesting that Marwick says at one point pineapples were cheaper than potatoes.
Pineapples are coming from Asia, they're coming from Caribbean. Oh, that's interesting. Latin America. I guess Latin America is neutral, but the issue is getting it into Britain, right?
Right.
Maybe potatoes are coming from America, Canada, whatever.
Now we've talked about the craziness of German military thinking. The British Admiralty had no clue what to do. They're like completely stunned. Jellicoe, the commander at Jutland, was now first Sea Lord, and he told an American admiral, I quote, "It is impossible for us to go on with the war if losses like this continue." And the American admiral asked, "Is there a solution?" And Jellicoe replied, "Absolutely none that we can see now." This is incredible. I mean, my reaction is, this is incredibly stupid. You've been losing ships to submarines since the beginning of the war, and 1915 was bad. You've had well over a year to come up with an answer to this form of warfare.
Right. And it's also a little bit hyperbolic to say it's impossible to go on with the war since they've been going on with the war like this, no? Are they trying to get the trying to focus the minds of the Americans to?
Oh, you think he was just being political? No. The truth is, the Admiralty had no solution, and the losses are really serious. So they've tripled from the 1916 levels. So that plus the refusal of neutrals to sail to Britain Britain is facing economic strangulation and possibly, you know, serious food shortages. How long can they keep fighting with that going on? So the Admiralty had nothing. It took it took Lloyd George to find a solution. And I did not realize Lloyd George is the guy who said convoys. Escort the merchant ships with warships.
And I've heard of this before.
Well, yeah.
It seems like
a simple solution, right?
He won this debate. Yeah.
Well, the Admiralty actually refused. Obstinately refused. They argued that merchant ships couldn't keep station. Like the merchant ships are like sheep. They'll wander off in every direction. We can't make them stay together. And I thought, isn't that interesting that you use the comparison of sheep? Because what do you do when you have a herd of sheep traveling? You have shepherds and you have shepherd dogs, right? Can't you see the... So the Navy, the Admiralty, they called a meeting of merchant captains who agreed with them. Yeah, we can't keep station. Like, where did they find these guys? The Navy also pleaded that there weren't enough destroyers to protect the Grand Fleet. So we covered this before, the idea that you have 100 destroyers who are busily guarding the big battleships. So we have too few destroyers to protect convoys. And they also said that 2,500 ships were leaving British ports every month. So I think this is where Steglitz got his number. Somehow he doubled it to 5,000. Lloyd George was no fool. He didn't trust their numbers. So he sent somebody to inquire at the Ministry of Shipping, where he found out that the correct figure for the number of ships leaving British ports every month was 140. All the rest of the ships going in and out, this is coastal shipping. So he presented his facts, the correct ones, to the Admiralty, but the admirals continued to refuse. They had basically put their professional reputation on the line against convoys, so they, to use modern terms, they doubled down. They stuck to their guns. So Lloyd George got his leg men, all of his secretaries and assistants, he got them to consult junior naval officers. They gathered statistics. He went to the War Cabinet and got their backing. And on April 26th, he went to the Admiralty and he took his seat as head of the Admiralty Board. Just to remind you guys, I'm the Prime Minister, so that I am, in fact, the head of the Admiralty, even if you'd like to pretend otherwise. And he issued the formal order that convoys were to be instituted.
That's a case study on how to operate in a bureaucracy, I'd say.
I found this really interesting.
They should teach this in business school.
So how do you think the Admiralty responded?
I'm going to let you tell it because it's amazing.
Just like that, the admirals suddenly discovered that they had been pro-convoy all along.
Why did you stop us from doing this sensible thing?
Yeah, this is what we meant to do all along. The first convoy sailed on May 10th, and they were an immediate success. So the ocean is incredibly vast. 100 ships sailing together were no easier for a submarine to find than a single ship. So, you know, the wolf packs, as they came to be called, you have a few submarines out there looking for ships. You know, they miss the convoys just as often as they miss single ships. And the convoys were dangerous to them because the destroyers are fast. And you have many eyes in a convoy and on these warships looking for periscopes. Everybody's spotting, right? With convoys, the rate of loss was 1%. Without convoys, it was 25%.
So this is so bad because it's they've got into this thing where they violated the rules and lost the propaganda war to try to do something that then failed.
Yeah.
So you lose, you've lost all the moral, you've had all the moral disbenefits, and you get none of the military benefits for breaking the rule.
Yeah. I don't think they ever had the moral high ground, but they were, you know,
yeah.
they have now adopted the low ground as their position, and it didn't work. So you're right. It's a double whammy.
That's the worst.
So by September of 17, the British and American shipyards were building as many ships as the British were losing. And by the end of that year, the Germans were losing more submarines than they could replace. 20 U-boats were sunk in the first 6 months of 1917, 43 in the second half. 20 were sunk by mines, 16 by surface ships or convoy escorts and Q-ships sank six each, and 12 more were lost to accidents. Now, unfortunately, the convoy system wasn't universal. You had ships from minor ports who still tried to go it alone, and the Mediterranean was still a happy hunting ground for a few German and Austrian submarines. So the British now had to basically supply France and Italy, plus the huge army at Salonika that was, you know, largely just sitting there. So the strain on British merchant shipping continued, and the margin for survival was still pretty narrow for a while. At one time, England had less than a month's supply of wheat. And a single ship carrying sugar was sunk, and that led to a ban on jam making. But the convoys worked. One writer that I consulted said this was Lloyd George's greatest move, and it was pretty darn significant. Now, American entry into the war had other effects. German ships sheltering in American ports were seized. American companies would no longer try to run the British blockade with goods for Germany. American destroyers could now provide convoy escorts. And the Straits of Dover were pretty heavily guarded, so U-boats were more often taking the northern route around Britain, around the top of Scotland. But now that America was in the war, more mines were available. The British had never had quite enough, or as many as they wanted, but now we have plenty. So the decision was taken to create a giant minefield between the Orkney Islands and Norway. I mean, I had to look at a map. I recommend it. And I wondered,
incredible.
How far is that? It's 250 miles. We're going to make a 250-mile long minefield. The U.S.
This is the kind of thing the Americans could do back then, right? It just, the rest of Europe must have just been like, wow, Americans.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is the thing the politicians had warned, right? Is American financial resources. But the German Navy had underestimated American naval resources. Like, maybe they don't have, you know, the warships that you're thinking of. But hey, when it comes to mines, they got plenty. In fact, the U.S. Navy did most of the work laying this minefield. By the end of the war, in that area, 13,000 British mines were laid and 56,000 American mines. 69,000 mines. It boggles the mind.
Yeah. For 1918 we're talking about? 1917?
Yep. So this made it more difficult and time-consuming for U-boats to get through. But they still got through. And how many U-boats were lost to this minefield? Three possibly sunk and three damaged.
It's not a lot of bang for the buck, I'd say.
No. Oh, boy. And they used mines in the Mediterranean. So the Mediterranean had been a happy hunting ground for the Austrians and Germans, now the Allies created a mine and net barrier across the Straits of Otranto, so the southern tip of Italy, barring the Adriatic, essentially. It wasn't very effective, but convoys were instituted in the Med, and they were effective. 10 submarines were sunk in the Mediterranean in 1918, and one captured. I found it interesting. The captured U-boat was commanded by Captain Karl Dönitz, who went on to command Germany's U-boat fleet in World War II. In August of 1918, and boy, was this good propaganda, the British published a list of the names of 150 German naval officers, most of them U-boat captains, known to have been killed or captured. So that didn't do much for German morale. It's pretty discouraging if you're a U-boat captain to read how many of your colleagues are dead or...
150, wow.
Yeah. Now, the Germans also tried another attempt to hurt the British, aerial bombardment. So they used zeppelins and airships, but they also had long-range aircraft that could carry bombs, and we'll get to that in another episode.
The British just kept calm and carried on?
Partly. There was enough panic, actually. So the peak strength of the U-boat fleet was 120 in October of 1917, but they never had more than 60 at sea at any one time. So total U-boats produced during the war, 334. U-boats in production at the end of the war, 226. So for all of the hype about the U-boat menace, the Germans seem to have realized it late. Right? I guess they still had their faith on the high seas fleet for years when they maybe should have been building U-boats. In October of 1918, Admiral Scheer recalled all of the U-boats. What he intended was to have them all accompany the high seas fleet on its final sortie. We're going to take all of our fleet, all of our submarines, and we're going to go and attack the British Grand Fleet. Now, the sailors aren't stupid. They correctly identified this as a suicide mission, and they mutinied.
Did you refer to this earlier, or is this a separate near mutiny? Yeah,
I referred to it earlier. They were pretty unhappy to have been sitting in harbor doing nothing for...
Right.
Since the Battle of Jutland. And they knew the war was almost over. So they knew this last action is just, you know, we're going to throw away
blaze
our
of
fleet.
Glory.
Yeah. And they weren't interested in going out in that blaze. So I had a few statistics for the significance of all of this. British merchant shipping loss, 7.7 million tons.
Wow.
That's over a third, 37% of their pre-war total. And of those losses, 6.6 million were inflicted by submarines.
Wow.
International shipping suffered worse, 12.8 million tons, and 11.1 million of those by submarines.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing where the more impact you have, the more it makes people angry, right? I mean, just becoming this rogue destroyer of the global economy is not going to win you
the war. Friends? No.
Yeah.
No. By comparison to the U-boat effectiveness, German surface ships sank about 568,000 tons. Mines sunk a little over a million tons, and German aircraft 8,000 tons. So using aircraft against ships is still in its infancy.
But submarines were an order of magnitude more effective.
Yeah. But U-boat losses increased steadily. From 1914 to 1916, they lost 46 U-boats. In 1917, they lost 63. And in 1918, 69. So the damage to them was done by patrol or hunting ships, by mines. Actually, over 100 by patrol ships and mines. 16 by convoy escorts, 11 by Q ships, 10 were rammed by warships or merchant ships, 19 were lost to accidents, and 19 were lost causes unknown.
If you're a merchant ship captain and you go and ram a submarine, does that not damage your own ship too?
Not so much. You're aiming really at the conning tower and or the periscope.
Okay.
And you don't have to, you know, ram it, like open it like a can. A little bit of damage is going to make it impossible for them to go down at depth where the pressure is greater.
They have to surface and...
Right. And then they're incredibly vulnerable.
Sitting ducks. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the, I guess I'm just weighing the losses, right? So you have millions of tons of ships sunk by U-boats and 178 U-boats lost.
Yeah.
And not only the loss of ships, but the money and energy expended trying to defend against U-boats.
Yeah.
Or the 100,000 mines that you laid to block U-boat routes. But in the end, the British blockade was more effective. Countries suffered from the economic disruption. And certainly the interruption in food, so I couldn't help but, you know, overlapping into civilian hardship. France suffered hardships. The winter of 1916-17 was pretty harsh, and they ran out of coal. Remember, the Germans were occupying northern France, which is where France got most of its coal. The pâtisseries had to be closed. And restaurant menus were severely restricted. The government encouraged cooperative and civic restaurants and industrial canteens. And this is also the origin of the prefix menu. So if anybody has traveled in France, you probably encountered prefix. So instead of ordering different items from a menu, you just order the prefix, and for this much money, here's the dishes that we're serving. So that makes it easier for these co-op and industrial canteens to serve people. The real brunt of the war, of course, as always, was borne by the peasants. And there was pretty major bitterness, you know, on the part of the country folk against the city folk. French governments continued to fall. France had three premiers resign. Aristide Briand in March, Alexandre Ribot in September, and Paul Painlevé in November. And that's when 76-year-old Georges Clemenceau took over. Clemenceau is going to make
guess it. Guess who's back?
the tiger. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. France also experienced pretty serious strikes in 1917. 689 strikes involving almost 300,000 workers. Whereas in 1916, they had 98 strikes and less than 10,000 workers on strike. Britain experienced the May strikes, and the government appointed a commission of inquiry, which found out that high prices for staple commodities were causing hardship and actual privation for the working class.
So they got their smartest people on that job, eh? I think it's the prices, you guys. Oh, well. What do you know? But yeah. This is interesting from the socialist perspective, because you can imagine they're looking around and thinking maybe this revolution is about to arrive, right? And they thought it was coming in the West, and the surprise is that it happened in Russia.
Well, for similar reasons, though.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. In a way, there's a mystery of why it didn't happen. The resilience of these Western countries is is interesting. The Western regimes, I guess I should say. Like, France was able to deal with it by having all this churn in their upper leadership without the regime itself having to fall. And Britain is just an incredible system for preventing revolution. There's just no way to have a revolution in Britain.
Yeah, and I have an additional theory. I mean, it's partly because I'm researching the Russian revolution now as we're doing this, but the economic suffering and the privation in Britain and France is clearly being caused by Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Russia, the realization gradually sinks in that our government is simply incompetent.
Right.
Right? We're not being blockaded.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So but then can't you I guess we'll talk about it when we get to Russia.
Yeah.
But like, why can't Russia just change ministers like France, right? Like,
oh,
why can't? Yeah. Yeah, but what but it wasn't enough.
No, it's always the usual suspects, right? So
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
once again I went to Marwick, and he compares unrestricted submarine warfare and the British blockade to the razor and the noose. Germany is being strangled to death, but they're going to try to slash Britain's throat before they die. Civilians in Germany, he says, were suffering far greater hardships than anything in Britain or France. The Germans are efficient, yes, but efficiency wasn't enough. A million women were working and thousands of children, but German production in 1917 was 30-40% lower than before the war.
Yeah.
And Marwick says that this is due to the weariness of an underfed people.
They're hangry.
They're tired, and they're actually, you know, suffering. He says they had ration cards, but the products weren't always available.
Right.
Men were subsisting on 200 grams of bread a day. That's a quarter of a loaf, and less than a quarter pound of fats a week. Total German consumption of meat in 1917 was one quarter of what it was before the war. School children and women's organizations collected kitchen waste, coffee grounds, kernels of fruit, acorns, chestnuts, stinging nettles, and pine cones to use as fodder for animals. They also collected waste of all kinds to contribute to the war industries. And they were angry. They were angry at profiteers and black marketeers. One Reichstag member said, "The black market has become the one really successful organization in our food supply system." Big industrial firms used their economic power or access to certain commodities to get better food for their workers. And some municipalities were able to do the same. But then local rivalries led to a pretty near complete breakdown of food distribution. Even those who were supposed to be allowed extra rations because they were doing heavy work were getting less than half of the necessary calories. By 1917, milk was unobtainable. And then you had scarcity of soap, leading to another danger, lice. So you have malnutrition and you have disease stalking a vulnerable population. The death rate for children under 5 increased by 50%. Deaths from tuberculosis doubled. And the government really had no choice but to plan a further reduction in the bread rationing in April. And that news led to a wave of strikes. Nearly 2 million workdays were lost. That's compared to a quarter million in 1915 and a mere 42,000 in 1914. Sorry, a quarter million in 1916 and 42,000 in 1915. And there was a second wave of strikes in June, And that's when German sailors bottled up in port, joined the workers and the food riders.
Wow.
Farmers had been better off, but now they were being subjected to food searches and all sorts of regulations. And government inspectors came to look for, you know, where's the food you're hiding, and the enforced slaughter of their livestock. So German morale was crumbling. And I don't think it's because they, you know, don't have the stomach for a long war. The conditions were appalling. You had selfishness of employers, jealousies between various townships, class antagonisms, and the hollowness of the, you know, the parliamentary, the facade of parliamentary government was revealed. And
I mean, this is another case. Why was only Russia, you know, why only Russia had a revolution, right? Like, why?
Germany came close. They did,
but it was a little later, right? It was just a little later. World War One had already wrapped.
Yes. Yes. I actually had it happen in 1917. I wonder. Yeah,
I know. It would have been a totally different world.
Yeah. And it interesting that all of these things that went on are things that Adolf Hitler would remember when it came to World War II. So contrary to what many people might think, Hitler's Nazi government went to war with a policy of guns and butter.
Guns and butter. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he made very certain that his civilian population did not suffer the hardships of World War I. He did not want to face a revolution. So Roskell says that civilian deaths in Germany during the war were 760,000 higher than the number indicated as probable by pre-war statistics. I've seen estimates of German civilian deaths that were over a million. And these are mainly you can directly connect them to the British blockade.
So like public health, like excess deaths.
Basically, excess death. Britain used the blockade to starve Germans and kill them by malnutrition and disease. Doesn't sound as bad as torpedoing ships without warning, but...
Right. You can see why they didn't get it. They didn't get why they were the bad guys.
Right.
How did the British always come out looking like the good guys?
Well, if you write the history, it's not that hard.
Indeed. So we're going up into the sky next?
Yeah. The air war.